Good morning, everybody. My name is Jacek Bartosiak. Welcome to Strategy in Future, another podcast today with a distinguished guest, Julien Lindray, French. Hello, Julien. How are you?
Hi, Bart. How are you?
Yeah, I'm fine. Difficult times, the year 2024. Just for the audience, we already recorded the podcast with Julien, but for those who are the first time on our channel, Julien Lindray, French, is the chairman of the Alfen Group. And the distinguished strategic thinker in the West, frequently giving his voice on Twitter and in other media on strategic matters of Europe and the world. So as an intro, let me put it that way. So I'll start right away with a key question. It seems that Ukraine is struggling. There is a feeling along the eastern NATO frontier among the countries there, where I am in Warsaw, that the Western countries, especially Western European countries, do not support Ukraine sufficiently, either to defeat Russia, but increasingly even to neutralize Russia, even to sort of keep them at bay. So let me put it this way, the question. What are the implications for security architecture all along Europe, all across Europe and the world, if Ukraine falls, if Russia is regarded as a winner of this confrontation? What will be the indirect and direct consequences for the security of the entire Europe?
Thank you, Jacek. And just let me say, great to be back speaking with you again on your hugely impressive podcast. Look, the simple dilemma at the heart of the Russo-Ukraine war, from the perspective of Britain, France, and Germany, the three most powerful Western European states, is this. It is a vital interest to them that Ukraine survives as an independent political entity. It is not a vital interest to them that Ukraine survives with the Donbass and Crimea as part of it. That is the essential dilemma that Ukraine is facing right now. So the consequences are apparent in the action of those three critical states. I might add, to some extent, also the United States.
Yeah.
Which is, we're giving Kyiv enough to stay in the fight, but we're not giving them anything like enough to prevail, to restore their 2014, let alone their 1991 borders. We're simply not. And that is why earlier this year, when there was much hype about the so-called Ukrainian counteroffensive, I was on the record early saying that this counteroffensive simply does not carry the weight, and it hasn't been given sufficient capability, 28 Western-equipped brigades, to break through Russian defenses. Russian defenses that, for all their incompetence, have been markedly improved over the last year. So we have something like what we have today, which is a kind of First World War-style Western Front stalemate, trench warfare, in which technology and humanity are being sliced up together. It is quite horrific. So Ukraine's fate really comes down to the clarity of objectives that the major Western powers agree should be the consequence of their efforts. And at the moment, there is no clarity, as I've said.
And why is that so? Let's try to, you know, disseminate. Why isn't it so?
Well, I'm about to publish a book with General Lord Richards, the former chief of the UK Defence Staff, called "The Retreat from Strategy," and it goes into great depth about, from a British perspective, why this has happened. First of all, our political leaders do not think strategically.
Okay.
They confuse politics with strategy. Second, they confuse values with interests. They're still hoping that somehow Russia will see the error of its ways and we can all return to living in a peaceful pre-February 22nd order, which really wasn't that peaceful.
So this is the self-denial behavior, right? The values will trump the interest, and the values are more important. This is what you want to imply, that the leaders have not been thinking about strategic interests for so long that they cannot digest it properly.
They're not up to it. I mean, they come from a generation of people who never knew a war. They never really knew the possibility of war. Those of us who had our formative years during the Cold War know what an existential threat looks like. Mm-hmm. I think Russia's genius, if you can call it that, evil genius, has been to create a war which on the face of it doesn't look existential to Western Europeans in particular, and certainly not to Americans, and yet implies a future existential threat. So in a sense, what our Western leaders are doing, whether it's President Macron, whether it's Mr. Scholz, whether it's Mr. Sunak, or even President Biden, is basically simply confirming all the prejudice that Vladimir Putin has about the West. We're soft. We have no strategic patience. We're not willing to face down any real threats. We can be bought off. And that if Russia just hangs on in there, Russia will at least get eastern Ukraine as part of the Russian Federation and intimidate the rest of Ukraine to remain within the Russian sphere of influence. This is a systemic existential challenge to the West. And whether it's willful or simple stupidity, our leaders are simply not up to understanding this.
So are you suggesting that the game that the Russians are playing is, of course, broader than Ukraine itself, since they want to establish themselves as a non-removable European power that for the balance of power, the Western countries need to accept, and in this way, Russia will have a say in crucial European matters? This is their strategic objective, and that our leaders in the West are underperforming to deny this objective. This is what you're suggesting, or this is my interpretation of your words?
No, this is absolutely what I'm suggesting. I'm suggesting that the Russians are playing poker and the Western Europeans are playing chess, which is a kind of reversal of roles given history. But never mind, that's what's happening. Putin wants to establish the new rules of the game, the great game, as we have a 21st century great game. And the Western Europeans, because of the European Union, like to believe it can all be done in terms of shared values, and that nasty things like balances of power and realpolitik, all the things that made Europe a very dangerous place in the past, they are indeed now part of the past. Putin is reminding us they are not. Mm-hmm. That the likes of Russia and China and India and even the United States still sees international politics as essentially driven by power in an anarchy, and therefore realpolitik and balances of power. And you know, I heard my own country's Secretary of State for Defense, Grant Shapps, speaking this week, and it was a classic example of this, what I would call defense derangement syndrome, where he was claiming that, you know, Britain's spending more in cash terms than at any time in history, that we're, you know, we've built aircraft carriers and nuclear submarines. The simple truth is Britain has a £17 billion defence black hole at the heart of its planning, and that the force has been hollowed out. The British Army is now so small it can hardly defend Britain, let alone NATO. And this kind of defense pretense is also apparent in France and Germany. And until these three powerful states, and with due respect to Poland, the British defense budget is about three times as big as the Polish defense budget. Until these three powerful states wake up and face the world as it is and not as they would like it to be, then I'm afraid this kind of nonsense will intensify the danger. I would suggest to you, Jacek, that the greatest danger that the Europeans face is not Putin, although in time it could become. It is this defense pretense from which our leaders suffer. They produce endless strategies, endless Zeitenwende, endless program, as the French would call it, But in fact, they deliver very little in terms of what is needed to deter the likes of Putin in the 21st century.
I fully agree, but let's make a step forward. But what does it mean for the future? What will the future bring in terms of danger or maybe war upon Europe? What happens if there is a sort of a wicked truce in Ukraine, and Ukraine is a sort of a falling, crushing country that cannot deliver economy properly? It's crippled by war, it's crippled, you know, in terms of the human capital, and it's crippled in terms of infrastructure, lack of resources, access to Donbass, and so on. And also it's not taken into the EU. And there are 2 more years. Putin is still not satisfied because he's not at the table, in European matters. And there are those 3 vulnerable Baltic states. There is Belarus. There is, of course, my dear Poland, and there are the Baltic states, Finland, Sweden. What might happen? What I'm saying is the audience has been used to having this war in Ukraine, but I think they don't grapple, they don't understand that the war might, I think, come to them.
Yeah, they don't understand linkages. They don't understand with respect the linkages between what's happening today and the future. Now, look, what we're heading for right now is a situation in which we, free Europeans, pay for Ukraine, but Russia controls it. That's what we're heading for right now. We're heading for a horribly European peace treaty.
Yeah.
In which a horrible compromise is reached, in which the Russians will claim de facto sovereignty over those areas of eastern Ukraine, Donbass and Crimea in particular, and Western Europeans will find some kind of language to justify it.
Yes.
What they don't realize is that the only thing that Putin has to offer the Russian people is his vision of a return to a Russian empire that never existed, this Novorossiya fantasy. And for that to happen, he has to maintain the momentum of threat that he's generated, which he pretends the Russians face. Now, the only way to maintain the momentum of threat is not to have a permanent peace in Eastern Europe. So the situation in Ukraine would be simply little more than a kind of extended ceasefire,
yes,
whilst he rebuilds the Russian military. And then the threat will transfer towards the Baltic states, the Black Sea, and indeed Finland and Sweden.
Yes.
Because he's not sure we're willing to go to war for the security and defense of these allies.
Sure.
That's the bottom line of all this. He still thinks we're not willing to risk. We're so risk averse that at the end of the day, there might be a crisis, but we would back down.
Yes.
And if he finds himself ever more under pressure, and let's face it, the value of Russian oil is collapsing right now, and all he cares about is regime survival, he will push the adventurism button again because he needs chaos to keep himself and his cronies in power in the Kremlin.
True. We call it Pieredyszka, which is an intermittent period between wars. And the Russians historically have been very good at doing those pretensions that there is truce or peace, and then they were gearing up for another period of wars. This is what we fear. Especially that in the grand scheme of things, it seems that we have a major worldwide potential U.S.-China conflagration where this Russian adventure might be a sort of a sideshow, given the sanction regime, technology regime, a potential conflict in the Western Pacific. So there will be so many flashpoints of grand scale that the Russians might be probing our resolve here easily. That brings me to 2 questions, which are tough, Julian. Pardon me for that, but tough.
It's what we're here for.
Yeah, in Warsaw, we are thinking hard, what the real situation is. this is, and we are already in the balance of power game, I think.
Yeah.
Less on the value, but balance of power. And we found ourselves weak, right? You know, at the starting point of it. So right now we're trying to build the force and, you know, prepare. It's a mental change. It's going to be hard. But we are wondering, first of all, the question number one, why the Americans are delivering that little? And we understand this because they want to control escalation. They want to have the balance of power in this way. But even in this definition, they underperform. We think that they didn't assess situation properly for their own interest, because it's the NATO and the U.S. presence that will be harmed if Ukraine falls, primarily. That's question number one. So why are they behaving like that? Are they also strategically not thinking properly? And the second, or maybe they don't have resources. And maybe this is a true truth that they have no resources to keep on like that. And the second thing is that maybe France and Germany have a different vision, Julian, for the future than US, UK, and, you know, those, as sometimes we were referred to as orphans of the Versailles Treaty, you know, those eastern countries between Russia and Germany that always hang on to the sea powers of England and the United States for support. And we, because we are the, you know, the anchor of NATO and so on. But maybe France and Germany really want to have this free trade, Eurasian trade, you know, peace and prosperity with Russia and the resources of Russia, the buffer zone of Russia, this Nord Stream thing, and, you know, easy life. Maybe there is an underlying the trend there. What do you think? I know these are tough questions, especially.
They're great questions, Jacek. Great questions. I mean, take the Americans first. Let's break that down. What we have is a very European administration in the White House. It's very domestically focused, and the Americans face big domestic issues in their cities that they understandably wish to focus on. After all these years of grand strategic engagement the world over, they've got a lot to fix. They've got a lot to fix in their society. They've got a lot of fix to fix in their infrastructure. If you look at the demographic of the Democratic Party in particular, these are not the internationalists of the past. These are people focused on U.S. domestic politics. Big questions like immigration on the southern border are really challenging Americans. And Americans of all political persuasions understandably say to Europeans, you know, we've looked after you for many, many decades. Now it's your turn. Because the bottom line is, we can't be strong in the Indo-Pacific, in Europe, in the Arctic, in the Middle East, all the time, everywhere, unless you pull your finger out. And they're right, by the way.
Yeah.
I call this the Doha effect. You remember when President Trump negotiated stroke, entre guillemets, as the French would say, with the Taliban in Doha for the withdrawal from Afghanistan? He didn't negotiate. He just gave Afghanistan to the Taliban. And Biden confirmed that. And basically what the Biden and Trump administrations are saying, we're not getting involved in these kind of wars anymore. And so there's a profound split, which you've seen in the Senate over the agreeing an extra military aid package to Ukraine over the Christmas period. There's a profound split in both the Democratic and Republican parties about what role America should play in the world, particularly in Europe. Because there's a split, there's no clarity. There's no sense of purpose. And if the Americans lack a sense of purpose, the Ukrainians suffer. You know, that old saying that when the Americans sneeze, Europeans catch a cold. Well, this is happening. Now, let me turn to France and Germany. Well, first of all, France and Germany don't agree. The French want l'autonomie stratégique. They still hanker after this kind of Gaullist view of a Europe standing alone, led by France, strategically autonomous, independent, that can act on the world stage as Europe. Well, but the problem is that no one wants to follow France, least of all Poland, for obvious historical reasons. The Germans, on the other hand, they're a mercantilist power. They just want trade. They just anything that disturbs trade, their export-led economy, they don't like. So they're willing to do a relatively small amount when it comes to preserving sea trade lines, sea lines of communication. This is why Germany supported the Anglo-American attacks on the Houthis in Yemen and not the French. The Germans did it because they want those sea lines of communication preserved for reasons of trade. But the Germans have no strategic vision at all. They have no sense of how strategic events lead to wider effects. They see everything as the here and now. And the Americans, the Biden administration, for all its many strategic failings, has become utterly frustrated. They quietly hoped, because Biden is no friend of Britain, Biden had quietly hoped that a Germany could replace Britain as the special relationship in the Euro-Atlantic axis. They've given up. For all Britain's failings, it's still the Brits with the intelligence, with other capabilities, that when it comes to the crunch will always be there. That's why last night four RAF Typhoons flew thousands of kilometers across the Middle East from Akrotiri in Cyprus to attack Houthi targets. Again, it's the Brits with their ships and their aircraft who are standing by the Americans. The problem is the Brits really can't bring that much to the table anymore. So the Americans find themselves overstretched. Now, you talked, Jacek, about Putin being, you know, his ambitions being a sideshow. At one level, they are. But imagine this. If Russia and China are undying strategic partners, and China, as Xi said in his New Year speech, will unify Taiwan with the People's Republic somehow at some point, then surely what Putin offers Xi is the ability to stretch the Americans thin the world over at China's convenience by creating multiple simultaneous crises in multiple theaters. Now, the Americans are saying quietly to Europeans, look, we know what they're trying to do. It's up to you Europeans to take the pressure off us by being effective in and around Europe. And if you do that, we will preserve the security guarantee to the Baltic states, to the Finns and the Swedes, and to Poles. But if you don't, then we can't guarantee that will always be the case. And that's where we're at, and that's what Putin is hoping to exploit.
Sure. You know, in grand strategy terms, I increasingly think of Halford Mackinder thesis. You know, compare Imperial Japan and Hitler's Germany. These were weaklings, not connected, not neighboring, without resources, without food. And the war lasted that long, while right now we have Russia and China pressing on the rimland of Eurasian landmass with so many flashpoints from, as you said, Finland and Baltic states, so Ukraine and Houthi, even who knows who gives them money and instructions, and even this Taiwan thing. The Americans are stretched in, but Ukraine is a critical flashpoint for the balance of power in Europe, and Poland is a critical flashpoint for the balance of power in Eurasia, in Mackinderian terms, which I think apply. I'm increasingly sure that the Chinese are thinking along those lines. And this is a special compliment to you as a British representative, let me put it that way, the reference to Mackinder. His theory still works in that respect. And this time around, it's just, you know, so we can theoretically say we have a scalable world war, but waged by nuclear powers, they try to limit the engagement and limit, you know, the escalation control so that there is no nuclear conflagration, but the world is on fire, in fire.
Yeah. I mean, think about when Mackinder was writing in the first decade of the 20th century. Think about what Britain, and he was considering the future of the British Empire. And what was Britain doing? Britain, when Wilhelmine Germany began to emerge in the 1890s as a transformative power in the heart of Europe, Britain was faced with a dilemma, which the Americans face today. How to preserve the home base, how to defend the sea lines of communication to India through the Suez Canal, and the way they, the solution that Britain came up with in the early, in 1904, in fact, was a treaty with Japan.
Yes.
That turned Japan into a naval power with British military technology.
Sure.
Many of the ships that took part in Tsushima, Battle of Tsushima with Russia, and indeed in World War II, were either British built or British designed, because we needed Japan to balance Russia and Germany at the time. Now, in the end, we had a triple entente with Russia to balance Germany. That collapsed, as we know, with World War One.
And you had Jackie Fisher, who really regrouped the fleet, yeah? So.
Well, he turned the Royal Navy from a global fleet of frigates into the Grand Fleet, which defeated the High Seas Fleet in 1916 and maintained the blockade. But we built the Grand Fleet at the expense of the Imperial Fleet.
Yeah.
And it marked the beginning of the end of the British Empire. World War One very much did that, and the emergence of first America and then Russia as powers. So we are seeing this Mackinder-esque center and periphery. The problem is the Americans are now dealing with at least two centers, possibly three, and many peripheries.
Yeah.
So how do you develop, generate effect and influence in all those areas simultaneously? Well, you need not only a grand strategy, but you need instruments of power across diplomatic, informational, military, technological, economic. The Americans have the capacity to do that, but they lack the strategy. The Europeans lack both the strategy and the capacity to generate instruments of power that are credible. So the result is that nuclear weapons, when Oppenheimer first demonstrated the atomic bomb at Los Alamos in 1945, far from making war too dangerous for humanity, has now made war safe for the use of conventional military power, because the likelihood of nuclear warfare is still so horrific that no one's really going to go there, especially nuclear powers. But at the same time, it has created a space for those with significant conventional military capability to use it against those that don't have significant conventional military capability. That is why the defense pretense of countries like Britain, France, and Germany has helped create the conditions for Putin to invade Ukraine. Because he saw a weakening America, he saw your Western Europeans who really don't care that much about what happens in your part of the world, as long as it doesn't affect them. They might talk about it as they do, but they don't. They saw a Britain which had a nuclear deterrent and sits on an island, and no one's really going to attack Britain because it could nuke Russia if it was attacked. Not really engaged post-Brexit in European security and defense, for all the rhetoric to the contrary. So you have this convergence of incompetences in Moscow, Berlin, Paris, London, and Washington, which has created this very dangerous situation with which you Poles, our Baltic friends, Ukrainians, and others must cope. It is a tragic Mackinder-esque disaster.
True. And you know, also increasingly we have this vacuum of power in our region, the Skinderberger trap, as the scholars call it that way.
Yeah.
And that we need to step up, of course. Poles have the guts to step up. Maybe we have technology, but in terms of resolve and the society's forces, if our strategic culture were more mature in terms of organizational, you know, skills, that might help. But in terms of the society resolve, it's there. It's there, and it lacks in the West. So that's a good sign. But, you know, increasingly we see and we look not to the collective defense as a sort of security measures, but we are on the lookout for B-party arrangements. if Ukraine were standing stronger and had a proper military, we would be thinking about allying with them. We are thinking about allying with Sweden. Just like, you know, we were watching closely, your prime minister came over to Kiev and signed this treaty, whatever, the agreement. We are thinking hard what it really means. What it means. Is this a new era of, you know, bilateral deals for security measures? What it means if the remote UK signs something with Ukraine at war? How we distill the words that are there. What does that mean? Maybe
I can tell you what it means. It means Sunak looking strong in an election year when he's unlikely to be re-elected. That's what it means. I mean, in London these days, everything is reduced to politics, not strategy. It's the short term. But then I have a question for you, Jacek, given the logic of your argument. If you don't trust, understandably, the Germans, the French, and the Brits to really be there, or even the Americans, in a real crisis, and given the logic of your defense policy, which I've looked at quite closely, the next step would be to discuss Poland having nuclear weapons.
True.
Would you go down that path?
That's a key question, Julian. You know, okay, I'll answer this, and then also I propose two other things that we are thinking hard in Warsaw. You know, first of all, I represent strategy. It's a sensitive subject. I represent strategy and future, which is an independent think tank. We are not related to the government, to public funds, and so on. This is critically important to underline that, okay? Yes. We think that at the end of the day, with the withdrawal of the U.S. forces from Eurasia, the local partners will be thinking about nuclear capabilities like South Korea, you know. And we should be thinking about that and also about the salvo competition with Russians so that we could really have second strike, even conventional, you know. So those are parallel things, missiles and nuclear capability. Somehow, of course, it would be hard because the geography proximity makes it really escalatory, you know. We don't believe that the Americans would ever allow that to happen because we are too close to Russia. We have had 19 wars and they don't want to be entrapped in anything, in any showdown, nuclear showdown, okay? And that creates a strategic dilemma for Poland.
Yeah.
Okay, we can discuss it now, you know, whether we should have a catalytic strategy like Pakistan did, you know, how we should approach. That's a big story. Maybe let's not during this podcast. We can discuss it separately. I'm happy to do so. I'm really happy that you opened up this subject. I was also thinking that if the Americans were decided to do an offshore balancing, like the UK Britain was doing in the 19th century to the European peninsula, therefore the proper balance of power, they should allow some allies in Eurasia and elsewhere, like Australia, have nuclear weapons to stabilize the system from the pressure from continental powers, you know? And I think it would be in the U.S. interest somehow. But that would kill the, you know, 80 years long tradition of non-proliferation in the U.S. strategic establishment. But I'm sure that Turks are thinking hard, Ukrainians are thinking about it. And maybe at strategy in the future, we're going to have a simulation next week, internal simulation. How this would play out in terms, you know, what the Americans would allow it. But one critical thing is this is strategy in the future. Okay. Our government, our political elites have been living in times of beautiful geopolitical weather. Okay.
Yep.
After the collapse of the Soviet Union, they have tough times to understand even realities of war, non-value, but interest-driven security arena, and not to mention nuclear weapons, Julian. You know, I hope they will deliver the proper modernization of the military. You know what I mean?
I know exactly what you mean. But Jacek, take this. The greatest cause of lowering the threshold of nuclear use in Europe, whether it's free-fall American B-61 bombs or the Anglo-French nuclear deterrent are weak conventional forces.
Yeah.
If your conventional forces are so weak they're overrun quickly, then it is you, i.e. us, who are responsible for lowering the nuclear threshold. Now, take my own country. If you look at our defense budget, the nuclear deterrent really works out about 6% of the defense budget every year. But it's 64% of the new defense equipment budget. Why? Because we're building 4 Dreadnought-class bespoke ballistic missile submarines for the next generation, which will be ready in the 2030s. But the problem is, on the current defense budget and the way that Britain spends money on defense, and the same goes for France, Britain can either be a credible nuclear power or have a credible deployable military conventional force for the defense of NATO, but it can't be both. And the same goes for France. So, in a sense, you have that stabilizing offshore second and third decision-making center nuclear system in Europe already. But neither Britain and France can afford everything that they need to make remain credible. And the reason is, think out to the 2060s when the next generation French and British nuclear submarines will be operative. That's likely to see an explosion in underwater drones with high sensors, making it very difficult to hide big bespoke nuclear submarines underwater.
Yeah.
That kills the assured second strike. Now, having nuclear weapons is not the end objective. The end objective is assured second strike. That means that the likes of Russia, whatever they did with their nuclear weapons, they'd always be struck by the West. So there's a debate opening up with emerging and disruptive technologies as to whether building bespoke ballistic missile submarines at great cost is in fact going to preserve a credible deterrent. We're going to have to rethink deterrence.
Sure.
And it's that I would suggest is the where we need to go intellectually. Sure. To consider cyber information, that's conventional great. Force, nuclear force. How on earth do we deter an adversary like Russia, given its vulnerabilities? Sure. What do we do to exploit Russia's many weaknesses? Those are the questions our leaders should be asking right now, not how much threat can we afford, which is the prevailing view in Western Europe.
True. Also, at Strategy in Future, we have been, proposing to Polish broader audience and the political elite that we should start pondering about deploying Polish troop deployment in the Baltic countries to Corbett's concept of fleeting being against Kaliningrad and Belarus, because if we move offensively we can really threaten, we can create the operational and strategic dilemma for Russians in Belarus and Kaliningrad. But we need to jettison this old-fashioned reactive stance, okay?
Yeah.
We also have had 19 wars. Poles were really prolific in thinking how to fight wars with Russia. And we are redusting, undusting old books, okay, at Strategy in Future, all the Polish strategic thinkers from 500 years ago. We could have light deployable forces that move along the long periphery of Russian empire, of Russian state, create, sort of the operational dilemma. We could start thinking offensively. We could have special operation forces. We could train the independent Belarusian army in Poland to have a say in the Belarusian matters so that the Russians do not feel safe, that they are at the terms of everything there. And it's we have a lot of immigration there. They want to do it.
It's a don't even think about it strategy. It was Mahan rather than Corbett who believed in the fleeting being. Corbett, okay. Corbett was the frigate imperial policing man. But your point is essentially correct. Poland, I've been calling for the creation of a new allied mobile heavy force that would be the outcome of the agreement at the Madrid summit for a new, heavier, enhanced NATO response force. Sure. Now, we need 50 or 60 brigades, rapid reaction, rapid mobile, air mobile, sea mobile brigades to make that credible. In Europe today, we have about 20 or 30.
Yeah. On top of that, military geography of the Eastern Frontier, as we call it in Polish tradition, is so it's flat. Open yeah. for, we need in order to really deter, Poland would need to have the active defense with yes. some preemptions. And it's, of course, under NATO, Article 5, this political, you know, quagmire. It's so difficult to deliver politically and so on. So we pose it that we should start talking to the Americans on the protocol of proportionality, how we could on our own react to things that would be probing NATO without waiting for the NATO to collectively agree that we could.
Well, this is the preservation of NATO, Jacek. I mean, what we need to do is to mirror what the Russians are doing in eastern Ukraine. What they've done in eastern Ukraine is forward deploy relatively poorly trained formations, but behind them they've kept heavy mobile forces that can plug any gap and exploit any weakness. The sort of Ekin line, they've learned the role of maneuver in defense. We need to do that strategically in NATO. We need to have forward deployed forces, but yeah. behind them an allied mobile heavy force
yeah.
that can exploit Russian weaknesses and simply say to Moscow, look, whatever you do with your First Guards Tank Army or your Western, Central, and Southern military districts, it ain't going to work. That is deterrence.
Sure.
And that is a European responsibility, and that is Europe's investment in NATO. And if Europeans don't do something like this and meet the obligations they've signed up to under the defense planning process, then NATO will erode because the Americans can't be everywhere all of the time. That's the bottom line of all this.
Yes, we increasingly more are inclined to talk to Swedes and Ukrainians, you know, with that
defense.
US hub and spoke system, sort of, as opposed to all those Germans and French who have no clue and we think and we suspect them of some wicked thinking, like consolidation of European Union that is in fashion now. We increasingly, as strategy in future at least, we think that this is a method to really start talking to Russians over our heads and sort of restraining our own security and foreign policy.
I can understand that, Jacek. But look, I wrote my PhD on all this nonsense many, many years ago. In fact, when I first started work in this business and had hair on my head, we were still talking about a common European force. It's never going to happen because to have a common European force, you need a common European government. You're yeah. not going to have France and Germany in yeah. charge of a large number of forces from people who've given their forces to France and Germany. They're going to demand a say. So, yeah. you know, it's a lot of it is just this old French Gaullist dream that France can run Europe. I mean, they've been watching that movie Napoleon perhaps a bit too much. And the Germans want a quiet life. So at the end of the day, it's still going to come down to those countries like Poland that have the will and the power. And it's up to Europeans now to recognize the Americans might not always be there. And all we Europeans, including us Brits, who are a key player in this, because when we do get our act together, we're quite impressive, to start coming together to build a European conventional defense which is credible in deterring Russia in whatever form it takes. Because at the moment, the Russians think they're winning. And there is nothing worse than a Russia that thinks it's winning.
True. Let's end now. It's a perfect summary of our conversation, which it was great. I really can't wait to have another one with you.
Thanks, Jacek. Always
Thank
a pleasure.
You very much. Julian Linde-French was our guest today. Thank you. Stay with us at Strategy in Future.